This is an ABC podcast.
Hello there. You're with Extra with me, Geraldine Doog, bringing you just some of the people and the stories that excite me each week. So great to have your company for the next half hour. What a week it's been for testing our limits over public conversations about difficult topics, for considering how we might conduct them respectfully in this increasingly changing community, on full display, you might say, with that 25 million population figure being registered. Just as that figure was announced virtually, a known racist stirrer was given a warm and welcome reception on Sky News, which was too much for ex-Labor Minister Craig Emerson, who, as you no doubt know, resigned in disgust at what he considered a new low in what's considered acceptable discussion. Well, the uproar that's followed, including a batch of advertisers withdrawing from the network, has merely highlighted a bigger question. Do we need to refresh the rules of engagement in public debates around delicate issues like community cohesion, immigration, just for starters? We've invited three guests to tease out what might be some new, or is it new old principles, some new etiquette in a sense. Andrew Jaspin, who is a professorial fellow at RMIT University, former editor of The Age and founder of the Conversation website, who looked closely as well into how the BBC handled these sorts of issues during the Northern Ireland Troubles. James Button co-authored an essay on immigration policies and politics in the most recent edition of Griffith Review. He's a journalist and former political speechwriter. He wrote a book about that called A Year in My Father's Business, his father, of course, being the late John Button. And Bernard Keane, Crikey's political editor, he recently published a book, Alan and Unwin published it, called The Mess We're In, which covers some of these issues. So, gentlemen, welcome to the program.
Hi, Geraldine.
I'm going to ask you all, just to get a sense from you all, do you think we can have a constructive, open conversation about some of these issues these days? First to you, James Button.
Yes, definitely, Geraldine. It's difficult, there's no doubt, but we can. I think that that people's anxieties, I guess, have to be acknowledged. You know, I have researched immigration, and obviously the immigration levels to Australia are high. There is a lot of benefit to that, but obviously some groups in the community are going to feel that things are changing too fast. And so I think if politicians are discussing that, I think they need to talk about the benefits that immigration brings while acknowledging that some people may have fears. I definitely think that there can be a constructive conversation, probably not with having neo-Nazis on Sky. Hmm. Definitely not.
Well, that's what I want to get to. Andrew Jaspin, what are your thoughts?
I broadly agree with James, but let me tell you, underpinning all of this is a very deep ideological schism that's going on. And it's kind of driven out of the US, and it's coming to our shores as well, which is around challenging science, challenging facts, challenging the very basis of the way in which we conduct conversations and discussions in public in a respectful way. And this kind of vilification of science and ideas and community is driving some very big challenges into the way in which we conduct ourselves in public. How do we have agreement around broadly what's right and wrong, what works and doesn't work?
Well, it's the art of persuasion, isn't it? We've somewhat forgotten the art of persuasion and rhetoric,
haven't we? But when you actually vilify positions, as in calling journalists providers of fake news, for example, attacking journalists, attacking facts, putting forward alternative facts, alternative scenarios, this kind of causes chaos in public discussion and debate. And there is a reason for causing chaos, because the idea is to try and dismantle the current order and replace it with a different approach. And these are very deep ideological wars which are being fought, and they're being fought through proxies. And, you know, those proxies are things like, you know, climate science, for example, being a hoax or whatever. And the same thing goes for vaccination or for a whole range of other issues. It is a deep ideological divide. And the key thing out of all this, Geraldine, is yes, we can debate these things, but I think we need to reinforce the rules as to how we're going to conduct these debates, and I think introduce new ones, and particularly ones which are transparent and open for everybody to see, you know, what are the facts, what is the basis of the information I'm getting, where's it coming from, and so on and so forth.
And Bernard Keane, how do you see it?
I'm much more pessimistic than Andrew or James. I think it's become, it is more difficult now to conduct a sensible debate about immigration. It's going to get increasingly difficult. Over the last 40 years, we've had, immigration is a tricky, complex subject, complex economically, complex in terms of things like social issues and culture. Over the last 40 years, Australia's had, or nearly 50 years, Australia's had a sort of a bipartisan approach on racial issues around immigration. There's been a bipartisan acceptance that a race-based immigration policy is unacceptable. That bipartisan consensus is starting to break down. We've seen Tony Abbott, a former Prime Minister no less, talking about African immigration. So that bipartisanship is under threat. But there are two much more recent issues that are making it much more difficult. One is the issue that so many people around the world in Western countries, whether it's Australia, the US, the UK, are deeply concerned about this perception that they are no longer in control of what's going on. They want greater control around the economy. They want greater control around borders. That's making the issue much more fraught. And the very environment in which such debates have to occur, the media, and I'm talking about the media in the broad sense, not just the mainstream media, but increasingly social media as well, that is fragmenting, has been fragmenting now for 20 years. That fragmentation is really driving us apart rather than bringing us together. At least the old analog media model, for all its flaws, at least brought us together, created a unified space. I think the media that we now have is driving us apart rather than bringing us together, and that's going to make discussion of these sorts of complex, nuanced and very sensitive issues increasingly problematic.
Yes, I was thinking that when I was training as a journalist, the question that you were not really supposed to ask terribly often was, how do you feel? It was more, how do you think about something or other? It might seem subtle, but in a way, that's what somebody said at after dark for the Sky people. There's very much a sense of people's emotions and sentiments and feelings being aired, whereas during the day, it's a completely different emphasis. So, Andrew Jaspin, that is a shift that has occurred, much more individualistic society, much more a sense you have a right to your feelings, and maybe you do. It's the question of whether you put any limits on the expression of those feelings, I suppose.
Well, yes. I mean, again, just paraphrasing some of what Bernard was saying a moment ago, I mean, what we have now is the ability for anyone to have a view. I mean, you can sit in a darkened room in an armchair and you know, write your blog or
exactly,
communicate in ways which are completely untutored and without any controls. And if you look at things like, for example, the ABC or the BBC or you know, any mainstream outlet, they have things around codes of conduct, ethics, charters, what's acceptable and not acceptable. That doesn't apply to a lot of the new social media outlets. But that's creeping now into you know, new outlets like Breitbart in the US and elsewhere. So what you are now getting is a breakdown in sort of understanding around the broad concepts which actually underpin discussions in this country. And those really are around, I think, around facts, rational and reasoned debates conducted respectfully. And those are not conducted in that way in certain quarters, and that is undermining that consensus which Bernard referred to.
But see, you know, James, in your very good essay that you wrote with Abdul Rizvi for the Griffith Review, your final sentence is very much an open question. If any society can confidently steer towards a future based on migration, Australia can. Can our leaders talk about this? Can we all question? Now, in terms of trying to work out how we do, what are the risks and what are the benefits of doing so?
Yeah, great question, Geraldine. Look, I think Andrew and Bernard are absolutely right about the current climate and how difficult it is to have a reasonable conversation. Excuse me. There is no doubt that social media, the politics of our day, the kind of rising heat and in the debate is making it really hard to have the sort of conversation you're talking about. But I do think Australia is in a better position than many places, certainly than Europe and the US, to have that kind of conversation, including around immigration, one of the most sensitive subjects. And if you look at the last 70 years, this country has been transformed from an insular, institutionally racist country to one of the most diverse and tolerant societies on earth. So to your question about how do we work towards that sort of conversation, I agree it's very difficult, but I think we look at the past, we say, you know, we have done this well over time, and we've done it not through some pretty tough policies. We've been very harsh in many ways about saying who comes into the country and who doesn't. But on the back of that, we've built a very successful society. And now we live in a region where the two largest and two of the most dynamic economies are China and India. And our two large migrant groups, two largest at the moment, are Chinese and Indian migrants. And so the opportunities there for the future in a country that is right next to those places, that has many connections. I'm not saying any of this is easy, but when is politics ever easy? Mm. It is up to leaders to say, look, you know, this is a great opportunity here that we could actually do something quite special. But at the same time, as I said at the start, you have to acknowledge that this is difficult, you know, that there are problems in our cities, there are problems of congestion, there are problems around integration, you know, when you're running large migration numbers, but that they've been dealt with before and they can be dealt with again.
Yeah.
Can I just add something there?
Andrew.
I think when we look at the sort of pressures which are building up in society now, things like, for example, about congestion on the roads or in public transport or poor public provision of social housing, all these kind of issues then become issues which are debated widely. But fundamentally, what I think there's been is a failure in public policy and investment in public infrastructure. And let me explain what I mean by this. The Productivity Commission 20 years ago said we wouldn't hit 25 million until something like 2030 or 40. So there was we just hadn't really planned the way in which population numbers were going to be increasing in Australia, and then meet those extra numbers with investment in infrastructure, in schools, in health, in transport, all those issues, which is actually now leading to the kind of problems we're having. And as a result, people then decide to exploit those pressures, introduce a little bit of fear around the issues, and bingo, we have the kind of debate we're having now.
Yes, some wit said it used to be populate or perish, it's now become plan or perish. and that, look, I suppose what I'm really intrigued by is whether we need some new places we will not go, and that it's generally accepted we won't go. I mean, listen to how Craig Emerson described why he finally, it snapped for him.
The Herald Sun ran a piece, a big page 3 column from Andrew Bolt saying these migrants don't assimilate. And he named the suburbs and the migrant groups, including Jews in North Caulfield, for what purpose? And there is this disgusting cartoon of 5 people from overseas in their national dress with their knives and forks out tucking into this pie of Australia, and he talks about they are not us. This is very, very close to pre-war Nazi Germany.
Now, Bernard Keane, I wonder if you've in your own mind assembled where you think the low might be and where that ought to be articulated, and so that there's a shame brought on people. Well, that's what happened to Sky this week, didn't it? There's shame if they invite certain people or engage in certain debates, and that will slightly shift the tone over time?
Well, you know, if we want to be optimistic, we'd say that, yes, there is some sort of threshold beyond which no one dares go. But if you look at the United States experience, there is no threshold below which you cannot plunge. It's That's an unusual circumstance in which you have Donald Trump, this sort of protean figure, whatever you might think of him, just seems to have extraordinary gift for not merely going wildly in excess of existing standards, but continually sort of resetting the standard ever lower in terms of things like truth, in terms of things like the areas where he's not allowed to go. So we don't have quite that kind of figure here to continually propel the standard ever lower. What we do have, though, is the same sort of forces that are driving people to ever more extreme. So that fragmentation of the media that I talked about earlier acts as a kind of a centrifugal force. Mm. I think we used to have this centripetal force in our media that brought us into the same space. We had the same facts, we had the same values. Values.
Well,
like,
they were gatekeepers, of course, and some people will be listening and saying, "Yes, they were gatekeepers, and I didn't get my say."
Well, absolutely. And look, I've been something of an evangelist of social media in the past, in saying this is a great way for people to connect up without the gatekeepers exercising that kind of control. And there's undoubtedly a positive aspect to it, but it comes with negatives because human beings aren't perfect. They're both positive and negative, and people of ill will have used that to connect up every bit as much as activists fighting for democracy and liberalism have done as well. So we've traded a centripetal media environment for a centrifugal media environment, and that just, I think, pushes people to ever greater extremes. So I think Sky News is a good example. Its business model is, and it makes perfect sense from a business point of view, to cultivate a certain kind of audience, and that audience tends to be older, conservative, probably heavily male, and the best way to cultivate that is for individual presenters to outrage that group ever more and more, and of course it becomes a kind of a competition on the part of presenters at that network and in the media more broadly to produce or induce ever greater levels of outrage. So you have this sort of,
yes,
this pressure to extremes rather than a pressure to the centre.
Well, interestingly, James Valentine on local radio is a very experienced presenter in ABC local radio in Sydney. I was talking to him about this yesterday, and he said he felt that the role of the moderator was becoming increasingly important. The tone set by, this is in broadcast debates I'm talking about or whatever, discussions, and that there ought, and Q&A, he quoted, that the moderator ought to insist on certain conduct and certain courtesy and certain good behaviour. I mean, James Button, is that this is what I mean. Should we be getting down to this rather granular level of discussion?
Yeah, it's very interesting, Geraldine. I think what James is saying makes a lot of sense. Just following up what Bernard said, again, I agree, Bernard. I wonder, will we get tired of outrage, or are we just going is the world just going to keep getting hotter and hotter till it catches fire? You go on social media and it's sometimes stunning to read what people are saying, and then you walk out in the streets and the streets are calm and people are getting on with their lives. And I don't know. I mean, maybe there's a kind of balancing mechanism. Yeah. I'm going to sound like a ridiculous optimist perhaps, but people will just think, they're sick of this new toy that enables them to vent and we'll just say, oh, for God's sake, let's just calm down a little. I don't know.
Geraldine, sorry, can I jump in?
Yes, Andrew.
I was just going to say that in the US, what you've now got is something called the Trump bump. So what has happened is people have tired of exactly what James is talking about, and there's been a flight back to quality. The number of subscriptions to the New York Times and Washington Post and a number of other high-quality outlets has just gone through the roof. The same thing goes for The Guardian. Worldwide now, 800,000 people are donating money to keep The Guardian afloat. And I think there is going to be, I think people are tiring of what they've been seeing. They want to find outlets that they can trust. But those outlets that they want to trust also have got to demonstrate in a much more obvious way now why they should be trusted. Now, into
that they represent the commons.
Yeah, but also into this, for example, Google has now put a lot of money into something called the Trust Project at Santa Clara University in the US. And this trust project has actually codified the behaviours that they expect to see in high-quality independent outlets. And those include, for example, full disclosure of ownership, of funding, of the way in which the reporters conduct themselves, whether they fact-check or not, whether they publish corrections or not. Now, all of these things are part of what I think is a public media literacy exercise that we need to go through, in which we actually are very tough on our source of information, and we question those before we take them on board. And then it leads to the second quick point, if I may, which is there is a requirement for diversity. And I'm very concerned about the developments of Fairfax and Nine here. There is the possibility of a tie-up between News Corp and Seven. That we are going to have fewer voices in a country which already started off with too few anyway. So there is an issue here around good outlets with diversity and media literacy around making sure that we know what we're getting and making sure that we can test those opinions across a range of different views.
Yeah, I just have to ask you, in the minutes remaining, the BBC's experience during the Troubles, and you've looked at this, it was very interesting, and I lived there through part of it. And my memory is that they came to a very interesting distinction. They would allow the Men of Violence's words to be there, but they wouldn't allow those men, they were men, to advocate violence on their organs. So you could hear some disturbing material, which arguably we need to, but they wouldn't allow anybody to use it to sool people on. Now, is that an interesting distinction, do you think, Andrew?
Yes, very much so. So the BBC is very much committed in its charter to impartiality, neutrality and balance, which means, in a sense, putting both sides. But they suspended those rules when it came to Northern Ireland because, of course, the BBC broadcast into Northern Ireland. And what they did was they agonized over all this. So you're quite right. They did allow people like Gerry Adams to actually come on the shows. But curiously enough, you were not allowed to hear their voices. So they got actors to actually mime, as it were, or put the
words. But you heard the sentiments.
Yeah. But they were very, very careful about who they let on. You're quite right. And in a sense, they abandoned that issue of balance into Northern Ireland, which at the end of the day was still part of the UK, and the BBC is a UK institution. So they did have to change the rules when they found that actually the civil unrest or warfare did not allow for the kind of debates which were conducted on the mainland.
Okay, final word to you, James Button. If there was one sort of code you'd like to see imposed, what would it be?
Oh, a code of media, do you mean, Geraldine?
Yes.
I think, treat each other. I'm going to sound very platitudinous here, but I think what James said, you know, like people can make their arguments as strong as they like, as long as they're respectful. And I do think it comes back to politics, Geraldine. I still think that with the divisions we have in the media, politicians still have that national platform to lead, you know, and to say this is where we're heading and this is why we're doing it. And I think that's what we've lost, sadly.
And Bernard, to you, final word.
Well, look, you know, we're four sort of middle-class professional people here, and we are intelligent media consumers. The problem is that, you know, even if we insist on high-quality outlets, fact-checking, all the important aspects of quality media, the media has moved away from us. It's no longer, you know, newspaper mastheads and TV stations and independent media outlets like Crikey. It's happening on Facebook. It's happening on Twitter. It's happening on web boards. That's the place where so much media is now happening, and there is no quality control, and there will never be quality control there, and that's the deeply worrying aspect of the environment that we now have.
Look, thank you all very much indeed. Some interesting tweets, texts have come in. Margaret reminds me of the great Yeats. The best lack all conviction, the worst are full of passionate intensity. Yes, that's quite true.
Well and said.
Yes. And another text, you and your guests all have easy access to the media to express your views. We, the great unwashed, are unable to get either media or politicians to listen to us. Social media is the only medium that allows us to raise issues. That's Jack. Okay, look, there's lots more to come on this. Andrew Jaspin, the co-founder of the Conversation website, James Button, whose essay is in the Griffith Review. It's terrific. And Bernard Keane is Crikey's political editor. His new book is The Mess We're In from Allen & Unwin. Thank you very much indeed, gentlemen. I'm Geraldine Doog. I do hope you can join me at the same time next week or online via the RN website.